Joanne Freeman, you can probably guess which one she is, is a doctoral candidate at the University of Virginia working with Peter Onuf. Her most recent published work is Dueling as Politics, Reinterpreting the Burr-Hamilton Duel, which appeared in the William & Mary Quarterly recently. And I must say, and there haven't been one whole hell of a lot of people who've been able to teach me something about Hamilton, but she has. She's spoken widely on the life and times of Hamilton. It says right here, daring even to do so in Charlottesville, the heart of Jefferson country. I gave the Thomas Jefferson lecture, and look at me. And I got away with it. She's currently completing her doctoral dissertation, a study of the logic of political warfare in the early national period, entitled Affairs of Honor, Political Combat, and Political Culture in the Early Republic. She's going to tell us about Hamilton.
Thank you very much for that generous introduction. And I want to thank you as well for inviting me to come and speak here today. My topic is going to be the founders as politicians. In 1818, at the age of 75, Thomas Jefferson wrote an autobiographical statement about his service as Secretary of State. Trying to make sense of the period's politics from the distance of time, he attributed its evils to one source, Alexander Hamilton. To prove his point, he related an anecdote. In April of 1791, Secretary of State Jefferson, Secretary of the Treasury Hamilton, Secretary of War Henry Knox, and Vice President John Adams were dining together at Jefferson's home. At the close of the meal, the conversation strayed into the subject of the British Constitution. As Jefferson recalled it, Adams said, "Purge that Constitution of its corruption and give to its popular branch equality of representation, and it would be the most perfect Constitution ever devised by the wit of man." At this point, Hamilton paused, Jefferson wrote dramatically as he recorded this incident, and said, "Purge it of its corruption and give to its popular branch equality of representation, and it would become an impracticable government. As it stands at present, with all its supposed defects, it is the most perfect government which ever existed." To Jefferson, this story held the key to Hamilton's politics. Hamilton was not only a monarchist, he wrote, but for a monarchy bottomed on corruption. It was Hamilton's corruption, defined by Jefferson as his ability to sway Congress to his will, that most disturbed the elder statesman. As he explained to Washington in 1792, Hamilton had at his disposal a squadron devoted to the nod of the Treasury. Out of the public eye and able to serve their own interests, such men would form the most corrupt government on earth. Jefferson's image of Hamilton remains powerful even today, the corrupt and manipulative schemer plotting behind closed doors. Hamilton did much to live up to this image, for he was indeed superb at marshaling and organizing a political fighting force. And his web of influence was wide-reaching. But to stop at this point, to condemn Hamilton without studying his politics in an 18th century context, is to limit ourselves to the conventional narrative of the Federalist era, a tale of virtuous Jeffersonians and corrupt Hamiltonians, complete with a hero, a villain, and a happy ending, Jefferson's election as president in 1800. Hamilton practiced politics in the midst of the violent partisan battles of the 1790s. In doing so, he was responding to contemporary people and events, attempting to define his office and its role in the process of government, and advancing his political agenda. His actions had a purpose and a logic far more complicated than the simple lust for power or lack of integrity charged by his opponents. To understand their significance and impact, we must try to see his world through his eyes. What could Hamilton have meant by his endorsement of corruption in government? Well, he sometimes deliberately said things to irritate Jefferson, and usually succeeded, but his comment at Jefferson's dinner table has a greater significance. In a sense, Jefferson was correct in selecting this anecdote as a window into Hamilton's style of leadership, for in praising the efficiency of corruption, Hamilton said much about his view of the practical business of politics. Corruption, in Hamilton's sense of the word, signified the very basis of efficient governance. Without the ability to bargain behind closed doors, the government would come to a grinding halt, its constitutional checks and balances producing a state of perpetual stalemate. Private agreements and political log rolling were the very stuff of politics to Hamilton. And a politician was both foolish and impractical to think otherwise. It was this assumption that led many foreign diplomats to single out Hamilton as the most cosmopolitan member of the new national government. Hamilton's understanding of his public office and his assumptions about politics went hand in hand. He assumed that the American Secretary of the Treasury would resemble the Minister of Finance as defined in France and England, a first minister whose agenda set the terms of debate in the legislature. Based on this assumption, he entered office in 1789 with a national economic system in mind, composed of a multitude of individual proposals, each requiring enactment by Congress. Congressional support was vital to Hamilton's success. Indeed, important enough that without it, he would have refused the office from the start. And the best and most efficient way to elicit congressional support was through the informal politicking and bargaining that many termed corruption of the legislature. Hamilton missed no opportunity to advance his agenda. Whether asked for a simple yes or no response to a petition or for straightforward information about federal expenditures, he managed to interweave policy proposals into his response. Each intrusion raised increasingly urgent questions about the role of the Secretary of the Treasury in proposing legislation. He seemed to fuel the government in and of himself. As Pennsylvania Senator William Finley complained in 1793, Hamilton seemed to take the whole government upon his shoulders. His reports spoke the language of a Frederick of Prussia or some other despotic prince, not the language of a dependent secretary under a free and well-ordered government. By using his connection with Congress to full advantage, Hamilton went far toward suiting his office to his ideals and expectations, but creating a public forum was only half the battle. To effect change, he needed reliable supporters, men who could speak for him on the floor, recognize and refute opposing arguments, and if nothing else, provide consistently favorable votes in numbers large enough to defeat the opposition. Some congressmen had strong ideological or personal reasons to support Hamilton. Others were less committed, and such men needed tending. They had to be persuaded to support Hamilton's program in principle and vote for it in practice. A national politics without a permanent two-party system was like a war without uniforms. Without the identifying label of membership in a particular party, friends and enemies were indistinguishable and ever-shifting, and loyalties were trustworthy only after close scrutiny and continual testing. And even then, the most diligent efforts to monitor one's congressional friends sometimes failed. To avoid just such an unexpected congressional loss, Hamilton focused much of his time and energy on courting and counseling his supporters. Sometimes he dispatched one of his particular friends, as they were known, as an agent to make his thoughts known, but sometimes indirect politicking was not enough. Often a controversial proposal required a sophisticated defense strategy or an organized attack. In such cases, Hamilton typically held an after-hours meeting behind closed doors to formulate plans. These strategy sessions outraged Pennsylvania Senator William McClay, who dubbed Hamilton's devoted followers his gladiators. A meeting of Hamilton and his gladiators was a sure sign that something significant would be attempted that day in Congress. This, the important day when the question will be put on the assumption of the state debts, McClay wrote in March 1790. I suspect this from the rendezvousing of the crew of the Hamilton galley. It seems all hands are piped to quarters. Now, McClay's choice of metaphor strikes at one of the most distinctive and most threatening characteristics of Hamilton's style of leadership. Bold, energetic, and organized, with a passion for military command, Hamilton led his supporters like a general at the head of an army. He sized up the enemy, devised campaign strategies, marshaled his troops, issued them orders, and spurred them into battle. It was this hierarchical, organized, quasi-military style of leadership that most disturbed Hamilton's opponents. Jefferson frequently resorted to military terminology when complaining about Hamilton's methods. He headed a squadron, a corps, a campaign. To Jefferson, such control over the legislature destroyed the government's intricate system of checks and balances, enabling the executive branch to swallow up the legislative branch. Now, Jefferson himself, he proclaimed repeatedly, had, as he put it, determined to intermeddle not at all with the legislature. If it has been supposed that I ever intrigued among the members of the legislature to defeat the plans of the Secretary of the Treasury, it is contrary to all truth. He was guilty, as he put it, only of enunciating his sentiments in conversation. And chiefly among those who, expressing the same sentiments, drew mine from me. Such protestations might be convincing until we look a little bit more closely at the unfolding of some of Jefferson's seemingly innocent dinner parties. On January 2, 1792, for example, he invited Representatives Thomas Fitzsimons of Pennsylvania, Amasa Learned of Connecticut, and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts to dinner, along with several other guests. After everyone but the three representatives had left, the conversation magically turned, as Jefferson phrased it in a wonderfully indirect manner, it just turned to the subject of references by the legislature to heads of departments. The four men discussed the mischief inherent in Congress's ability to request reports from executive officers, leading Jefferson to note in a memorandum at evening's end that Gerry and Fitzsimons were clearly opposed to such references. 2 days later, when the House referred a question to the Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson noted with some satisfaction on the same memorandum, Gerry and Fitzsimons opposed it. 2 weeks later, Fitzsimons again opposed a reference to Hamilton, and Jefferson again took careful note of it. Finally, 6 weeks later, on March 7th, Republicans in Congress broached the issue in earnest, arguing that the House was capable of doing its own business. After an animated debate, Hamilton's supporters prevailed. Gerry changed sides in favor of Hamilton, Jefferson added to the bottom of his memorandum. His innocent dinner party was in truth a deliberate attempt to test and reinforce the sympathies of potential supporters in the House, the start of a campaign against Hamilton's congressional influence, documented in Jefferson's detailed memorandum. Jefferson was indeed simply talking with friends, yet he was also engaged in a political discussion criticizing Hamilton's influence over the legislature. A discussion aimed at encouraging three representatives to vote along properly Republican lines. Thus, in the same way that Jefferson was justified in attacking Hamilton's command of a squadron of supporters, Hamilton had every right to accuse Jefferson of guiding, as he put it, a formed party in the legislature bent upon my subversion. It was Jefferson's denial of his active politicking that so enraged Hamilton, leading him to brand Jefferson a hypocrite. In the same way that Jefferson could boast of his unwillingness to influence congressmen, Hamilton could pride himself on his candor and honesty in acknowledging that his political strategy sessions were indeed just that. Unlike Jefferson, when Hamilton wished to engage in a political discussion, he said so explicitly. Compare Jefferson's masterfully indirect dinner with a similar dinner orchestrated by Hamilton. "I wish to have the advantage of a conversation with you," he wrote to Robert Morris in November 1790. "If you will name a day for taking a family dinner with me, I shall think it the best arrangement. The chief subjects will be additional funds for public debt and the bank." "Would you have any objection that Mr. Fitzsimons should be of the party?" Each man was most discomfited by the other's distinctive style of leadership. Hamilton distrusted Jefferson's indirection and secrecy, and Jefferson despised Hamilton's open command. Yet both were affecting the same purpose. Both were executive officers who wanted to advance a political agenda within Congress, and the practice was by no means limited to Jefferson and Hamilton. On several occasions, even President Washington attempted to influence congressional votes through the persuasive efforts of his secretaries. His use of Virginia Representative James Madison as a wedge into Congress was so customary as to be considered routine. And on April 2, 1792, disturbed at the implications inherent in a request by the House for executive department documents, the cabinet as a whole decided to speak separately to the members of the congressional committee and bring them by persuasion into the right channel. The cabinet decided to influence a congressional committee, a decision that Jefferson considered routine enough to merit only the briefest of mentions in a memorandum. Clearly, it was Hamilton's manner, not his methods, that so bothered his contemporaries. He issued commands. He had a congressional system. Jefferson's more indirect style of politicking enabled him to deny his influence in Congress even to himself. By drawing a distinction in his mind between private social functions and public business, he could host strategic holding his stance of political detachment. Such intellectual line drawing enabled him to denounce Hamilton for the very sins of which he himself was guilty. Jefferson's indirection might have afforded him some peace of mind, but it could scarcely compete with Hamilton's energetic congressional campaigning. It was Hamilton's ability to marshal his forces quickly and quietly that enabled him to defeat a 1792 proposal to ban congressional references to executive officers, a bill championed by Representative James Madison and deliberately aimed at subverting Hamilton's power and influence. Informed of the bill the night before the final vote, Hamilton used much industry, as Jefferson later put it, to influence key congressmen and won the field. In Hamilton's much more colorful words, "My overthrow was anticipated as certain, and Mr. Madison, laying aside his wonted caution, boldly led his troops as he imagined to a certain victory. He was disappointed. Though late I became apprised of the danger, measures of counteraction were adopted, and when the question was called, Mr. Madison was confounded to find characters voting against him who he had counted upon as certain." Roll call votes were clarifying moments that differentiated friends from enemies by forcing politicians to declare their loyalties. Congressional elections were likewise defining moments that forced politicians to take sides. The 1792 elections were particularly important. Convinced by early spring that there was organized opposition to him in Congress, Hamilton well recognized that his success in office, as well as his reputation and career, rested on his ability to preserve his influence in the national legislature. He thus initiated a nationwide campaign in support of Federalist candidates. He considered his actions justified by the urgency of the crisis at hand. In letter after letter, he apologized for intervening in congressional elections. "Let me not be thought to travel out of my sphere," he asked South Carolinian Charles C. Pinckney, as he did just that. To effect his purpose, Hamilton made use of his national prestige and influence, publicly sanctioning his preferred candidates by word of mouth and in letters written explicitly for circulation. He also asked friends to transmit campaign promises to more distant reaches of the Union, for example, asking General William Irvine to tell his friends in the Western Territory that Hamilton favored the taking of the Mississippi by force. According to Clerk of the House and ardent Republican John Beckley, Hamilton had spoken with Irvine in seeming confidence, assuming a guise of secrecy with full knowledge that Irvine would be sure to spread such confidential and thus important information. Like others, Hamilton relied on a nationwide network of friends, their support secured by the unspoken assumption that it earned them the reciprocal support and influence of their high-placed political chief. Typically, he had one or two particular friends in a state whose job it was to marshal support, disseminate favorable newspaper essays and pamphlets, convert the unconverted, and prevent supporters from straying from the path. South Carolina Representative William Loudon Smith was particularly active on Hamilton's behalf. Not only did he influence the local political elite, but he also had a great interest in the political leanings of the Southern backcountry. And this is a wonderful example of the reality of what they considered to be determining public opinion. On at least one occasion, Smith toured the far reaches of South Carolina and Georgia to determine and sway local public sentiment, reporting his findings to Hamilton in great detail. Smith chatted with people he met on the street or in taverns, offering Federalist pamphlets, newspapers, and conversation wherever he went. Because he was a congressman, a rare sight on the frontier, his opinions were invariably respected. To identify people who had strayed from the Federalist path, he looked for men reading the Republican National Gazette. In one case, spying the newspaper on a farmer's mantle, he expressed shock at discovering something so reprehensibly partisan in a seemingly decent household. And of course, he left behind a copy of what he deemed the liberal national newspaper, the Federalist Gazette of the United States, confident, he later explained to Hamilton, that his stay will not have been without some benefit. Spotting a man on the street reading what he deemed the wrong newspaper, Smith likewise offered him the Federalist Gazette, later assuring Hamilton that before I left him, he was quite one of us. In the early Republic's small-scale, localized political realm, such individual conversions might mean the difference between victory and defeat. In his strategic use of these friends, Hamilton differed from his peers in manner more than method. He was bold and direct when others were hesitant. Far different, and thus more threatening, was his use of Treasury Department subordinates, what the ever-vigilant Republican John Beckley called Hamilton's organized system of espionage through the medium of revenue officers. The Treasury Department was the largest in the government by far. By 1801, it employed over half of the total civilian government personnel. supported by a staff of hundreds of customs officials and revenue officers. It had influence in every city and section of the country, touching on commerce, land ownership, finance, and the mails. Secretary of the Treasury Hamilton thus had at his disposal an organized network of political friends incorporated into the government's very infrastructure, a cadre of public men commissioned to report on state affairs. Their names appear throughout Hamilton's correspondence, the sources of local news and gossip, an advance warning system about hidden enemies and brewing plots. This national web of influence enabled Hamilton to wage a coordinated national campaign against his foes, to transmit and collect information, to monitor and influence electoral campaigns, and ultimately, to fill the House and Senate with loyal supporters who owed him allegiance for helping them obtain office. An ingeniously indirect means of furthering his goals, Hamilton's organized network of agents raised troubling questions about the nation's federal system of government, about the ability of the states to preserve their autonomy, and the ability of Congress to resist the directive force of the national executive. Republican John Beckley both admired and feared Hamilton's coordinated campaigning. As he wrote to Madison in September 1792, "With a subtle and contriving mind and a soul devoted to his object, all his measures are like the links of a chain dependent on each other, acquiring additional strength by their union and concord." But Beckley's observations did not go unheeded, for even as he noted the effectiveness of Hamilton's network of friends, he helped to create a Republican equivalent. That same month, he traveled to New York to meet with the state's leading Republicans and encourage a joint campaign. He made similar efforts in Pennsylvania. Such tactics proved highly effective, for the Republicans made great gains in the congressional elections held 2 months later. If Hamilton's organizational methods were so effective, why was it the Republicans who emerged victorious? For Hamilton, it was Thomas Jefferson's election to the presidency in 1800 that taught him the error of his ways, for it revealed to him that he had focused on corrupting the wrong people. In his mind, he and his Federalist friends had maintained a virtuous distance from the American populace, assuming that the superiority of their policies and candidates would earn them votes. It was politicians who needed the most persuasion in the art of politics. The Republicans, however, had corrupted the American people with their shrill newspaper polemics and public demonstrations and won the presidency. "The Federalists have neglected the cultivation of popular favor," he ruefully admitted in 1802. "To win political victories, they would have to learn from their opponents. As he put it, they would have to unite in corrupting public opinion." Thank you.